Well, we've made it up to slide 2 in the chapter. And slide 2 is a representation, well, it's a chemical reaction, as you see. But this specific chemical reaction, which is one that we've looked at before, this is the first chemical reaction that we looked at in the course. Sodium and chlorine reacting. But anyway, what you see here is an example of a reaction that is redox. Remember that I told you we would be talking more and more about redox after I first defined it in the laboratory. What is redox short for?
Reduction
in oxidation. And it's good, actually, as I think I told you, to use one word to describe both, because you can't have one without the other. So you either have both or you have neither. In other words, if reduction happens, then oxidation also happens, and vice versa. So now who wants to remind me of what reduction is? I actually know, but remind me anyway. Right. Reduction is the gain of an electron, which is kind of linguistically counterintuitive, right? Reduction, you normally think of as a loss of something. But it makes sense when you think of it in terms of charge, because an electron is negatively charged, therefore gaining an electron is adding a negative one to you, which makes your charge go down. The opposite of that is oxidation, which is the loss of an electron. Now, what's another phrase that we use to describe the thing that becomes reduced?
Oxidized.
No, it becomes reduced, so it is reduced. But what do we call that thing if it becomes reduced?
Oxidizing agent.
Right, the oxidizing agent. Because it can't become reduced by receiving an electron unless something else becomes oxidized to give it that electron. All right, so the oxidizing agent becomes reduced. Conversely, the reducing agent becomes oxidized. That's in any redox reaction. There's going to be a reducing agent, an oxidizing agent. There's going to be something oxidized, something reduced. Now, hopefully it is clear that a reaction like this, which is an ionization, is redox. Ionization involves transfer of electron. So certainly that's going to be a redox. Something's going to lose the electron, something's going to gain the electron. Well, specifically, it's the metal, sodium, that loses the electron, and the nonmetal, chlorine, that gains the electron. It's one electron that's being transferred, but that shows you that something can't be reduced without something else being oxidized at the same time. And so it's the sodium here, by losing its electron, that is becoming oxidized. And therefore, sodium would be considered the reducing agent, because when it loses its electron, it gives it to chlorine, and chlorine becomes reduced. And similarly, chlorine here is the oxidizing agent, because it becomes reduced, but it causes sodium to become oxidized. That's just a specific example. Slide 3 is a generalized example. X and Y don't actually represent, I mean, they're not real symbols for elements. They just are variables. X is some atom, some element, Y is some element, and E minus is an electron. So X, E minus just means at first, before the reaction occurs, X has the electron, Y doesn't. X loses it, Y gains it. So X, E minus becomes oxidized. It's the reducing agent, and so on. Just the same exact thing that we saw previously, except this is the general example. Now to 4. Those previous slides were ionizations, and ionization certainly is redox. But even though we've been defining reduction as the gain of an electron, we see in chemistry that you can have redox reactions in which there isn't actually a transfer of electron. There isn't actually an ionization. In other words, reduction can be, in a sense, the partial gain of an electron. By partial gain, what I mean is that an electron might get closer to an atomic nucleus than it was before. And we discussed energy levels, right, which are correspond to closeness to the nucleus. So if an electron ends up closer to an atomic nucleus, it's going down in energy. Right? Here we have, in 4, an example of a combustion reaction, which is really what you were doing when you were burning food the other day. Combustion is reaction of a fuel with oxygen. And in this case, what is the fuel? Methane, the simplest hydrocarbon. Hydrocarbons in general make for excellent fuels, as I've said. And that's because they have CH bonds. CH bonds are rich sources of chemical energy. But hydrocarbons are also organic, right? So this particular combustion reaction is an organic fuel, specifically, that is being combusted. The fuel wouldn't have to be organic for it to be combustion, but this one is methane. And when you have an organic fuel being combusted or reacted with oxygen, then the output, the products of that combustion are carbon dioxide, energy, and water. So the material outputs are carbon dioxide and water. And notice that those are exactly the two outputs of the process that we're studying in this whole chapter, the complete oxidation of glucose. Complete oxidation of glucose is a combustion reaction also, except that it's a stepwise combustion. It's not happening all in one step like this is. In other words, here we have one quick, immediate release of this energy because we would put flame to the methane. In the presence of oxygen, that's going to cause CO2 and water to be produced. That's what happened to the food that was lost when you burned it. It became CO2 and water in the air, and that's why when you weighed what was left, what you were weighing was the food that didn't burn. Okay. Energy, though, is an output. It's not a material output. It's an output, though. So this tells you it's what kind of reaction. What word would you use to describe that?
Exergonic.
It's exergonic. Energy comes out. Combustion reactions are exergonic. They release energy. And that energy can be harnessed. This is why cells burn their fuels. They burn their fuels to release energy in the hopes of capturing some of that energy to do the temporary work, or the storage work, I should say, of producing ATP molecules, which is now holding some of the energy that the fuel did. And then the ATP can pass that energy on to some endergonic process, as we've been describing. Now back to the idea that redox doesn't have to involve ionization. This is an example. Notice methane's configuration here and oxygen, the two reactants. Methane is a hydrocarbon, and hydrocarbons are nonpolar. What makes them nonpolar? Why are hydrocarbons in general nonpolar?
Because carbon and hydrogen have the same electronegativity.
Exactly. Carbon and hydrogen have almost the same electronegativity values. So the sharing of electrons in a bond between carbon and hydrogen is equal sharing. Well, the dots here, the blue dots, represent the pair of electrons shared by the carbon and the hydrogen. And notice that they're placed midway between the carbon and hydrogen. In other words, they're not particularly close to either atomic nucleus. Oxygen is greedy, but in an oxygen molecule, you have two equally greedy oxygen atoms. So those shared electrons, there's four of them here, are also not close to one nucleus or the other. But when you rearrange things, which is what the reaction does, notice what happens to the electrons. They become closer to the oxygens in carbon dioxide and to the oxygen in water. Electrons are going down in energy because they're getting closer to an atomic nucleus. That explains the release of energy. Does that make sense? Well, this oxidation of fuels, and it's always the fuel in a combustion reaction that becomes oxidized. It's the fuel that becomes oxidized, it's the oxygen that becomes reduced. But the oxidation of fuels is how we release energy from the fuels. And in essence, what we are doing is picking the hydrogens off of that fuel. Which is why if you do that completely, if you completely spend the fuel, completely burn it or completely oxidize it, there aren't any hydrogens left on the carbon skeleton. This is a simple carbon skeleton, just one carbon. But notice there aren't any hydrogens left. The hydrogens end up on oxygen, which is why it produces water. So oxygen gets, in a combustion reaction, oxygen gets reduced to water, and the fuel gets oxidized, the organic fuel, gets oxidized to carbon dioxide. Whether you are putting a flame to methane, like in this, that's what you were burning when you burned your food. The natural gas is methane. But it's also true if you're burning fuel in a cell, like glucose, the master fuel. And that's why we're looking at this in this chapter, because this is not just about industrial use of fuels for the purpose of running machinery or whatever. It's how cells work. It's how they extract energy from their fuels. But see that this is not ionization, even though it still qualifies as redox. All right, now to five. Ignore the blue text for a minute and just look at the black symbols making up this chemical reaction equation. This is written as though this is one step. And you could do this reaction in one step if you put flame to glucose, which is what C6H12O6 is. Now, glucose is just one example of C6H12O6. We've talked about the fact that there are multiple hexoses, right? Other hexoses have the same chemical formula because they're isomers. But specifically, C6H12O6 here represents glucose, the main fuel. Did you have a question?
Isn't this a cellular respiration?
Well, it isn't, but that's what I'm just about to get to.
Ah.
So it to have one step, to have this reaction be one step, a combustion, would mean that you are actually putting flame to this or heating it up enough for it to happen all in one step. And notice you have an organic fuel and oxygen. This is not methane, but it's another organic fuel. And when you have an organic fuel that you react with oxygen in a combustion reaction, you have the same products as when you did with methane. Carbon dioxide and water, and you release energy in that process. So you can make this happen in one step, but cells can't. Cells don't want this to happen in one step because there would be an explosive an immediate release of energy.
It'd probably kill the cell.
Right, it would kill the cell. And even if it didn't kill the cell, it wouldn't give the cell the opportunity to efficiently harness maximal amount of energy that's being released. So it would be more wasteful, even if it could survive that release all at once. And therefore, this reaction is not cellular respiration, or actually, I shouldn't even use the phrase cellular respiration. This is not the reaction equation for the complete oxidation of glucose, which is the whole process. But this is considered the summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose. A summary reaction pretends that a pathway, which consists of many reactions, happens in just one step, even though it doesn't. The reason we can pretend that usefully is that even though it is in reality in a cell many steps long, a pathway still has a beginning and a final end. You're just ignoring the intermediate steps here. By summarizing the entire pathway, you say, here's what you begin with, ignore the steps, here's what you end with. All right? And by the way, if you do a reaction in one step like this, there's a certain delta G associated with it. Remember last time I said that delta G depends only on the reactants and the products and not how you get there. So if a cell does this in many steps, still the overall delta G for the whole pathway is the same. You're just going down little steps at a time.
Trying to get as much energy out of it.
That's right, to minimize that waste as heat. Okay, so as I said is generally the case, it's the fuel that becomes oxidized. That's how we get energy from our fuels. We oxidize them. And since this is happening in steps, it's possible for a cell to only partially oxidize its fuels. In which case, some of the energy that was originally in that fuel can be harnessed, but not all of it. This is why I'm calling the entire process, which cellular respiration is just a part of, I'm calling that whole process the complete oxidation of glucose. This is the complete oxidation of glucose because by the time you're done, this 6-carbon fuel has been completely oxidized, which means two things. The carbon skeleton, which is 6 carbons big, has been completely dismantled, and all of the hydrogens have been picked off of that skeleton. That's why you, instead of having 1 6-carbon thing, you have 6 1-carbon things, carbon dioxide molecules, no hydrogens in there at all. The hydrogens end up on oxygen to form water, and that releases energy. All right, now to 6. This is a chemical reaction as written, but notice that the first reactant here isn't a complete thing. This isn't a complete molecule, right? You see some bonds hanging off. And so what this HCOH with 2 unmet bonds represents is just part of the carbon skeleton of a sugar, or of a fuel in general, but specifically a sugar here, because this is just part of the glucose. Think back to building glucose. It's a monosaccharide, right? It's a 6-carbon monosaccharide, but remember that each of your carbons, except the end, had a hydrogen and a hydroxyl on it. That's what this is. This is one of the carbons in the skeleton. It has a hydrogen and a hydroxyl on it. The rest of the carbon skeleton isn't shown here, but it's really there. It's not shown because we're dismantling or oxidizing this fuel one piece at a time. All right? NAD plus is something I haven't talked about at all yet. This is an important player in the game. NAD is an acronym. It's not a chemical symbol. It's not from the periodic table. NAD is an acronym that stands for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. And we'll look at a structural formula of it in a minute. And NAD is an important energy-carrying molecule. Now, we already have talked about another important energy-carrying molecule, which is what? ATP, adenosine triphosphate. And ATP is what kind of molecule, molecularly speaking? It's what?
A polypeptide.
No. A polypeptide is a polymer of amino acids.
Or polynucleotide.
It's not a polynucleotide because it's just one subunit. It's a nucleotide. ATP is a nucleotide. And so it's an important energy-carrying molecule, obviously, in a sense the most important one. And if you want to think of things in terms of goals, this whole process, the complete oxidation of glucose, has the goal of forming as many ATP molecules as possible to store as much energy as possible of the energy that was originally in the fuel, the glucose. So ATP is the goal because it's the versatile molecule that can power so many different endergonic processes. NAD, though, is an energy-carrying molecule as well. It's considered functionally a coenzyme. Coenzymes are molecules that carry things from one place to another. And the things that get carried by NAD are electrons. Actually, electrons and protons. So I want you, just by analogy for this chapter, to think of NAD molecules as little taxis. Each molecule is one taxi. And just like a real taxi, it can either be empty of passengers or it can have passengers. If it's empty, it can pick up passengers. If it already has passengers, it can't pick up any more. But it can drop them off. And that's what coenzymes do. Pick up and drop off. All right? Now, the passengers are electrons and protons, as I just said. Where do those come from? The fuel, which is glucose in our case. And specifically just this one piece of the glucose skeleton. So the passengers are subatomic particles, electrons and protons. But what do you have if you have an electron and a proton? A what?
They cancel out.
Well, they don't cancel out. They're still both there. Their charges cancel out. But what if you have one electron and one proton? What do you actually have?
Hydrogen.
A hydrogen atom. Yes. Okay, remember I said that hydrogen atoms get picked off of the fuel to extract energy from the fuel. Okay? Now these taxis, NAD, since they exist in either of two forms, they're always going back and forth between those two forms. Empty taxi, full taxi, empty taxi, full taxi. But since the passengers include electrons, when one of these taxis picks up an electron, what is happening to that taxi, chemically speaking? Well, what process is happening? If a taxi is picking up an electron.
Ionization.
Yes, but a process that we're talking about in this chapter that we've... What? Yes, it's being reduced if it picks up an electron, right? That's what reduction is, the gain of an electron. And when it drops the electron off, it's becoming oxidized because it's losing that electron. So there's many, many cars in the overall taxi fleet. Each individual NAD molecule is one taxi, but there's a hell of a lot of them in the fleet. But any individual NAD can exist in either of two forms, the reduced form or the oxidized form. And I want you to get it straight in your head now and memorize it, that the reduced form is the full taxi. It's carrying the passenger, the electrons as passengers. The oxidized form is the empty taxi. It's able to pick something up. The reduced form can drop it off. Well, these electrons that come from the fuel are carrying energy. So that's why these taxis are, as I described them, energy-carrying molecules. These coenzymes, NAD coenzymes, are energy-carrying molecules because the passenger, the electrons, represent energy from the fuel originally. Okay? Now let's explain the stoichiometry here. NAD plus is the oxidized form of NAD. The empty taxi version. This is before it has received anything. It doesn't have a passenger right now. And notice, without a passenger, it has a positive charge. Okay, there are two hydrogens in this little fragment of fuel that we're concentrating on. Two hydrogen atoms. But don't think of them as atoms. Think of them as subatomic particles. So if you have two hydrogen atoms, what do you have as subatomic particles? Two electrons and two protons, exactly. That's what you have to work with. That's what you're taking off the fuel. Okay? Now, take just one of those two electrons and hook it on to NAD+, and that makes it NAD. Now take the other electron and one of the protons together. That's a hydrogen atom. That makes it NADH. But you still have one more proton left over that you haven't used. And that's why the reduced form of NAD is NADH, but we write it as NADH and H+, because there's still a hydrogen ion on its own, in a sense. Can't fit in the taxi. It's just walking down the street, in a sense. It's part of the pool.
Is it walking down the street or is it on top of the taxi?
Well, it could be on top of the taxi. Depends on how drunk it is. Okay, so that's what's happening here. And this is what we do to our fuels in general. We pick off the hydrogens to gain the energy. That's a redox reaction. The fuel becomes oxidized because the electrons of the hydrogens are being removed. And the coenzyme gets reduced because it picks up those electrons and protons to become NADH and H+. And just like a taxi isn't going to keep that passenger forever, it's a temporary thing, going to eventually drop it off, that's true of the coenzymes. The coenzymes, the reduced coenzyme, NADH and H+, is carrying a lot of energy. Quite a bit more than an ATP molecule does. But ATP is the goal. NADH isn't at the goal yet. So by dropping it off, as we'll see later, eventually the energy that it is carrying, the NADH is carrying, will pay off in terms of making multiple ATP molecules. All right, that's the importance of these coenzymes. They're little taxis, energy taxis. Now, what do we know about dehydrogenase? What are the two ways you know this is an enzyme?
ASC, and it's on top of the...
Right, ASC, and it is on top of the arrow, not on one end or the other. It's not a reactant or product, it's an enzyme. Well, this is an example of an enzyme whose name comes from the job it performs rather than the substrate it acts on. It's a dehydrogenase because the action it performs is dehydrogenation, which means removal of hydrogen. It's exactly what you're doing to the fuel. You're dehydrogenating it by picking those hydrogens off. And the hydrogens end up in the taxi in the form of individual electrons and protons. Any questions so far? Okay, go ahead.
With the taxi reference, do the protons count as passengers too?
Yes, they are passengers, definitely. And there, we'll see later why they're both important, electrons and protons. They end up doing different things, and they end up reuniting, not necessarily the same electron with the same proton, but they come back together in the end. We'll look at that detail later. Notice what's left of the fuel, though. Oxidation, right? It's being picked free of hydrogens. And if you do the same with all the other parts of the carbon skeleton and then break those carbons apart, well, all you have left is carbon dioxide. Completely spent fuel. That's what you should think of CO2 as. Completely spent fuel. There's partially spent fuel because you can start this process and do just a little bit at a time. And we'll see many examples of that. But when you finally get to CO2, there's no more energetic value for the cell at that point. The fuel is completely spent. Okay, now in the 7, we're looking at a structural formula for NAD. Nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, as I said, is what it stands for. But look at this phrase. First of all, you can see from the phrase that it is a dinucleotide. Two nucleotides hooked together. Yes, exactly. Remember what makes up one nucleotide? A pentose, 5-carbon sugar, a nitrogenous base that's hooked to that pentose, and a phosphate that's also hooked at a different place to that same pentose. So if you ignore this top stuff and you have just these three things, this is ribose, this is adenine, and this is phosphate, if those were by themselves as one 3-part chunk, what would it be? It would be a nucleotide, but specifically it would be AMP, because this is adenine. So this nucleoside is adenosine, and you have a phosphate hooked to it. That's adenosine monophosphate. But anyway, that's one nucleotide. Well, we talked about there being 5 nucleotides that are usually used in constructing nucleic acids. That is true. There's the 4 for DNA and there are 4 for RNA that are usually used, but that doesn't mean those are the only possible nucleotides. On the top part of this, we have another nucleotide. We have a ribose connected to a nitrogenous base and a phosphate. But the nitrogenous base here is nicotinamide. All the stuff in the white box is nicotinamide. That's one nitrogenous base. DNA and RNA don't use it, but this molecule does. And those two nucleotides are held together by their phosphates, so the whole thing is called nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, NAD. And this left part, all of this stuff in blue, is the oxidized form, which is NAD plus, remember. It's oxidized because this taxi has not yet picked up any passengers. The passengers are 4 passengers in the form of 2 hydrogen atoms, but really that's 2 electrons and 2 protons, right? When you reduce nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, in other words, when you reduce NAD+, that transforms it, like I've talked about in the previous, to NADH. But then you also have this extra proton that's not really in the taxi. And the rest of this blue, which isn't shown on the right, is still there. They just didn't list it again. Because the business end of this molecule, as far as its ability to carry the things is the nicotinamide nitrogenous base. The rest of it is just part of its structure. All right, so this is the part that changes, the nicotinamide part. And notice the reversible reaction here, the double arrows. A dehydrogenase enzyme catalyzes the removal of hydrogen, or in other words, the dehydrogenation of the fuel to get those two electrons and protons from the fuel. Three of those four particles end up on NAD plus to make it NADH, and then you have a proton to spare. And NADH, NH plus, is the reduced form. It's the full taxi, carrying a lot of energy. Okay, but it's reversible, meaning that obviously this taxi can drop them off. And when it does, that reoxidizes NADH and H plus back into NAD plus, which, like a real taxi, can then go pick up more passengers and carry them. Slide 8. We have another combustion reaction here, but this is not an organic fuel. The fuel here is hydrogen gas. Since it's not an organic fuel, you're not going to get any carbon dioxide as a product, right? But it's still a fuel, and if you don't believe that it's a good fuel, just look at the footage of the Hindenburg disaster. The United States during the war was, they were basically keeping all the helium for themselves, which is why the Germans ended up using hydrogen, which does the job. It's nice and buoyant, but it's also explosive. So that's why it went down. If you react hydrogen with oxygen explosively, or as a one-step combustion, you end up just with water because there's no carbon involved. But that releases a lot of energy. Notice that the y-axis here is free energy. So you have a G value up here, G value down here afterwards, and therefore a negative delta G. Well, this is if you do it all at once, an explosive release of heat and light. I mentioned earlier that cells don't do that because it would kill them and it wouldn't allow them to capture energy usefully. It would just heat them up, which is why it would kill them. Instead, the hydrogen, just like the hydrogen gas contains two hydrogens, in a cell, the two hydrogens come from the two hydrogens that get picked off the fuel. But it's still two hydrogens and therefore has the same delta G value associated with it if you allow it to be combusted stepwise, resulting in water. And this stepwise idea is why in a previous slide, in the previous chapter, I told you that not only are organisms open thermodynamic systems, but they are like multi-step hydroelectric open systems, right? Because it's not just one release of the energy, it's a little bit at a time. And that really comes into play in something we'll study later, which is called electron transport. A little bit of energy gets released at a time that allows maximal harnessing of that energy. By harnessing, I mean non-wasteful. You are at each step wasting some as heat. But this allows you to maximize the amount that gets usefully harnessed in the form of making a bunch of ATP molecules. That's the goal. But you end up with water because these hydrogens that got stripped from the fuel, even though they're separate electrons and protons during the process, an electron from a hydrogen and a proton from a hydrogen originally end up coming together on oxygen, which is the oxygen you breathe, to produce water. So the oxygen you breathe is the oxygen for combustion. The hydrogens come from the food that you ate. And when you do this combustion reaction in your cells, you make water. Think back to the reciprocal relationship slide, that slide one that we looked at last time, between photosynthesis and complete oxidation of glucose. Think back to today's slide that I showed you, the summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose. The outputs are carbon dioxide, that's what's left of the fuel, just an empty carbon skeleton dismantled, CO2, and the hydrogens that used to be in that fuel go on to oxygen that you breathe to form water. Water is an output of the summary reaction. All right, now we can get to the particulars of the process. And by the process, I mean, again, the complete oxidation of glucose. We're in slide 9. And this is a summary slide of the entire process. So the overall process is one huge set, in a sense, if you think of it in set terms. And then there are parts to it, or subsets. And they happen in a particular order. In other words, this whole thing is a process with a beginning and an end. And this is why, if you have not yet taken my advice about studying by giving your own lectures out loud to determine whether you or not you actually know the stuff, this is the best time to try it, because it has an order to it. If you can explain this stuff that we're about to learn from beginning to end without looking at anything, then you're ready for the test. And if you can't, you're not. But the complete oxidation of glucose has two major subdivisions. We're going to subdivide the subdivision, so be prepared for that. But the two major subdivisions of the overall process are glycolysis, which you see here in the teal box, and cellular respiration. Remember, I said that cellular respiration is really just part of the process. It's not another name for the complete oxidation of glucose. Now, this is not just a summary. It's an anatomical diagram, in a sense, because the overall brownish background here represents the cytoplasm of the cell. So it's inside the cell, but it's outside of the organelles. The yellow thing, of course, is a mitochondrion. We've already discussed when we did the survey of the cell that the mitochondrion is the organelle in eukaryotes in which cellular respiration occurs. But the first part of the overall process is glycolysis, and that does not happen in a mitochondrion. That happens in the cytosol, the liquid part of the cytoplasm, the cell solution, in other words. Now, glycolysis, I say, is the first part of the overall process, but glycolysis itself is a complicated pathway. There are 10 steps to just glycolysis. So don't think of it as one step, even though it's the first part. The first part is actually 10 steps. It gets the name glycolysis, though, for what reason? What does that word tell you?
Breakdown of glucose.
Of sugar. Glyco means sugar.
Breakdown of sugar.
Right, of monosaccharides. And lysis is splitting, right? So sugar splitting is what it linguistically means. But specifically, the main sugar is glucose. Now, glycolysis, splitting of glucose, that meaning of the word should tell you that this comes first, right? Because glucose is the sugar, and that's what you start with, is glucose. So the first thing you do is partially oxidize the glucose. And that's why glycolysis by itself is not the complete oxidation of glucose. This is just getting it started. But because the dismantling of this carbon skeleton in glucose originally partially happens during glycolysis, that means glycolysis just by itself will produce some ATP, which is the goal. All ATPs are the same. So anytime you have, along the way, ATP produced, that ATP doesn't have to be modified anymore. It's ready to go. Now, the reason there are three arrows here is to tell you that this is not just one step. It's not three steps, though. It's 10. Glycolysis accomplishes, in those 10 steps, the partial dismantling of the carbon skeleton, but specifically what's happening here is you're starting with a 6-carbon fuel, glucose, and you're, let's look at it on a per molecule basis. A single glucose is a 6-carbon fuel. You're starting with that. And after these 10 steps, you end up with 2 3-carbon fuels. And each of those is called pyruvate. So pyruvate is partially spent fuel, because you've gotten some of the energy out of the glucose, the original fuel. That's why you were able to make ATP. But the pyruvate still has valuable energy in it. It's not yet carbon dioxide, which is completely spent fuel. All right. So glycolysis only partially accomplishes the overall goal, which is the complete oxidation of glucose. ATP, as I said, is the goal, but it is only one of the energetic or the energy-carrying outputs or products of glycolysis. Even more importantly than the ATP that's produced by glycolysis are the reduced coenzymes that glycolysis produces, the taxis. So glycolysis gives passengers to some taxis. NAD plus gets turned into NADH. So if you think about this first part, glycolysis, in terms of inputs and outputs, the material inputs into glycolysis are the fuel, which is glucose, low energy adenosine nucleotides, in other words, ADP, are inputs. Oxidized coenzymes, NAD plus, are inputs. All right? The ADP, lower than it could be energy, is coming in because it wants to be energized into ATP. So the outputs are ATP, because the ADP that comes in gets phosphorylated into ATP. Another output is NAD plus, NADH and H plus, sorry, because the NAD plus, which came in, is picking up electrons from the fuel. And then the other material output is what's left of the fuel, which is pyruvate. And there are 2 of them. So 1 glucose comes in, but now you have 2 particles of partially spent fuel that's still valuable stuff. Okay? And of course, energy is a non-material output, but the energy that hasn't already been wasted as heat, which of course there is some, is now at the time that glycolysis is done, stored in the form of ATP that got produced, and in the form of NADH and H+, reduced coenzymes. They're carrying energy from the fuel. Is that all clear? That all happens out in the cytoplasm. Okay, now for the second major part of the overall process. Glycolysis is the first. The second major part is cellular respiration. And some people will tell you that glycolysis is part of cellular respiration. It is not. So don't be afraid to correct them if that ever comes up in conversation. Cellular respiration is a process that happens glycolysis is a process that occurs whether cellular respiration happens or not. And it's the starting process. Cellular respiration comes later, and if it happens at all, it happens in a different compartment in a eukaryote. And that's what we're studying here, is a eukaryote. Cellular respiration occurs in a mitochondrion, as you see on the map here. Well, the output of glycolysis is where glycolysis occurs, which is the cytoplasm. That's where the pyruvate is at the moment. That pyruvate is the fuel at this point. It's what's left of the fuel. So in order for it to be further processed, which is what cellular respiration is, a way to further burn the fuel that's left over from glycolysis. But in order for that to happen, that pyruvate, that remaining fuel, needs to get put into the mitochondrion for that cellular respiration to happen. That's represented by this arrow. Okay? The pyruvate has to be imported into the mitochondrion. And there are two pyruvates for every glucose that you started with. So that's overall part two, cellular respiration itself. Glycolysis, I said, has 10 steps. So part one is subdivided into 10 parts. Part two, which is cellular respiration, is itself subdivided into 3 subparts, which are then going to be even further subdivided. But what I'm trying to say is that there are 3 major parts to cellular respiration, all of which occur in the mitochondria. Only 2 of them are listed here, but the first one isn't. The first one is just really represented by this white arrow going into the mitochondrion. But the first part of cellular respiration is called the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate.
What?
Just as I said, oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. That is the name for step one of cellular respiration. Oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate.
Of pyruvation?
Oh, sorry. You should always write down what I'm thinking, not what I write.
Yes, you just gleam that in your mind.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll look at the particulars of oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate in a different slide, but here it's simply represented by this white arrow. In other words, pyruvate doesn't just go in, it gets changed in the process, and we'll look at that later. That's happening in this white arrow. That's part one of cellular respiration, which is, in a sense, part one of overall part two. The next part of cellular respiration is something that goes by any of 3 major names. One name is the citric acid cycle. It can also be called the Krebs cycle. That's an eponymous name, meaning it's named after a dead human. Well, they don't have to be dead, but Krebs is. I think he's still dead. Another name for it is tricarboxylic acid cycle. Which is why some people give it the name TCA cycle, tricarboxylic acid. Now, these are 3 interchangeable names. Krebs is the easiest to say, but it doesn't really tell you anything about it, right? It just tells you the name of the human that they honored by naming it that. Citric acid cycle makes sense for reasons I'll get into, and so does tricarboxylic acid cycle. But citric acid cycle is what most biologists would call it. Tricarboxylic acid cycle is what most biochemists would call it. Anyway, that's the second part of cellular respiration. And then the third part is oxidative phosphorylation, shown in purple here. But it is itself broken into 2 parts, which are electron transport and chemiosmosis. All right, and each of these parts still has multiple steps to it that we'll look at.
That's a lot of steps.
Yeah. Took them a while to figure it all out. Okay, now look at these little ATP balloons on the bottom. Remember, that's the goal. ATP is produced, some ATP is produced by glycolysis. No ATP is produced by the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Notice. Some ATP is produced by the citric acid cycle. The overwhelming majority of ATP gets produced in the final part of cellular respiration, which is oxidative phosphorylation. And that's why this balloon is bigger. The ATP is chemically identical. There's just more of it here, is what this is representing. Well, even though the end result is identical molecularly, ATP gets produced two different ways in this overall process. The ATP that gets produced in glycolysis is produced the same way as the ATP that's produced in the citric acid cycle, by a method called substrate-level phosphorylation, which we'll look at in a separate slide. But you can probably guess that it involves a substrate, and therefore an enzyme, right? The ATP that gets produced in the final step of cellular respiration happens differently, and that is why it's called oxidative phosphorylation. We'll have a separate slide about that eventually. Doesn't matter to the ATP itself. Once it's produced, it's the same as any other, but how it's produced is differently in these. Finally, before we leave this slide, notice what's happening to the taxis. And this is why I say that you should think of them as taxis, which carry passengers from one place to another. NAD plus picks up some passengers from the fuel in glycolysis. And notice it drives it to a final destination, which is the oxidative phosphorylation part, but specifically the electron transport part of that. The electrons get transported. Well, they are the passengers that are being carried. The electrons are in the fuel originally, in glucose originally, but they get carried by coenzymes, NADs, NADHs, to this ultimate destination, which is where the big payoff is in terms of ATP produced. What we'll see in a different slide is that there's also some NADH that's produced in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. So it's also going to drive it to the same destination. And there's also NADH that's produced in the citric acid cycle for delivery to the electron transport chain. This FADH2 is a similar, it's like a competing taxi company. Still does the job of carrying electrons and protons, but it uses different cars. And so that's also a product of the citric acid cycle. We'll look at that eventually as well. But any questions about this overall summary? Is he able to handle the detail at this point? Okay, tell me if you can. Let's go to 10 now and talk about what substrate-level phosphorylation means. Remember, this is how ATP gets produced in two different parts of the overall process, in glycolysis and in the citric acid cycle, which is the minority of ATP, because as I said, most of the ATP is made a different way in the end. But substrate-level phosphorylation is named for the fact that some substrate is carrying phosphate to begin with. In other words, a substrate is phosphorylated before the reaction occurs. That's this green with a phosphate on it. And substrates do exactly what you would guess substrates do based on the definition of substrate. They bind to an enzyme, the purple thing. And in that binding event, what the enzyme catalyzes is the transfer of the phosphate from the substrate to ADP, adenosine diphosphate, turning it into ATP, and you also have a now dephosphorylated substrate that comes out. The phosphate is carrying a lot of energy, which is why ATP has a lot of energy. So you're transferring energy from the substrate to ADP to make it ATP. You're making a deposit in the debit card account. Now, where does the energy come from? The fuel. It comes from different parts of the steps involved in glycolysis and later in the citric acid cycle. So this is an example of useful harnessing of the energy released from the fuel. This is not wasteful heat. This is actually storing some of that energy for later use. That brings us now in slide 11 to glycolysis itself. Now, this is not a biochemistry course, so I'm not going to make you memorize every tiny detail of glycolysis. But what we see in this opening slide for glycolysis 11 is that the overall process, overall glycolysis, which can also be called the glycolytic pathway, just another name for glycolysis, even though it exists as 10 steps, as I've said, you can think of it in energetic terms as having two major phases, which are the so-called energy investment phase and the so-called energy payoff phase. Each of these has multiple steps to them as far as reactions are concerned. But it's useful to think of it in these two phases because although the goal is to produce ATP, glycolysis actually can't happen unless you first spend some ATP. That's what the energy investment phase is. It's an expenditure of ATP to set things up molecularly properly so that the rest of it can proceed and pay off. In money terms, it's kind of like the adage, it takes money to make money, right? You invest so that you end up getting back more than what you invest, hopefully. Look at the balance sheet. It takes two, and these are per glucose. All of these numbers are per individual glucose molecule. For each glucose that enters, it requires two ATP to be spent, and by spent, I mean hydrolyzed, right? Turned into ADP, an inorganic phosphate. It takes two of those for every glucose to prepare the fuel so that it can then go through the energy payoff phase. And per glucose, four ATP are produced in the energy payoff phase. But it took two to get there. So the net gain of ATP on the bottom, the final net, is two ATP per glucose. That's the goal, so that's valuable stuff, ATP, right? But that's not actually the majority of the useful energy that is gotten out of the fuel in glycolysis. Because notice that in the energy payoff phase, in addition to ATP, NAD plus also gets reduced into NADH and H plus. Two of those per glucose. And each one is more valuable than multiple ATPs. So never lose track of the fact that these reduced coenzymes are carrying a lot of the energy that was originally in glucose. In terms of fuel, you started out with glucose. After the 10 steps are complete, you end up with 2,3-carbon pyruvates and waters. The ATP, I just described, and the NAD plus gets reduced in NADH and H plus. The only energy that's not accounted for here in the bottom is wasted as heat. Nothing you can do about that. Pyruvate, remember, is still valuable stuff. And the reason it is because it still has a carbon skeleton with hydrogens on it. So it can still be further oxidized. This is just partial oxidation of glucose, and it's a partial dismantling of the skeleton. 6-carbon into 2,3-carbon. Slide 12 is a depiction of just the energy investment phase. So this isn't all of glycolysis. This is the first 5 steps, which is the energy investment phase. So you should expect AT to be spent here, and notice it is in two different places. The first 5 steps are half of the overall glycolytic pathway, so it's 5 reactions, end-to-end, arranged, right? But for an individual glucose, originally, ATP gets used here in the first step, and then another one gets used in step three. And that's why it's 2 ATP spent per glucose to get you through the energy investment phase. The very first step, of course, gets rid of glucose because in a reaction, reactants get turned into products. So you only have glucose until the process starts. And then that gets not dismantled right away, notice. Glucose is a 6-carbon sugar. Well, that gets turned into glucose-6-phosphate, which is still a 6-carbon sugar. But it's called glucose-6-phosphate because it's glucose with the 6th carbon now phosphorylated. The phosphate group came from ATP. So you're spending some energy from ATP to energize the sugar and therefore make it able to go through the rest of these steps. Still no breakdown of the skeleton, though. Hexokinase is shown here. You don't have to memorize these enzyme names, but notice that all of these end in ASE. They are enzymes, specific enzymes. It takes a different enzyme for each step. But glucose-6-phosphate then gets turned into fructose-6-phosphate. That's still a 6-carbon sugar. So there's no dismantling that has occurred yet. Then you have to spend another ATP to make what's called fructose-1,6-bisphosphate. It's bis and bi mean the same thing, 2. So this is now a 6-carbon sugar that's doubly phosphorylated because you've spent 2 ATP. All right? Still no breakdown of anything as far as dismantling is concerned. But now we are going to dismantle it. Now that we've energized the fuel and made it into different isomers, they all have the same chemical formula, but they're different sugars. Now it's time to break it, the 6-carbon sugar, into 2 3-carbon chunks. That happens at this fork in the road at the bottom, which is shown in greater detail on the right. This is just a copy of this. And the reason this is a fork in the road is that breaking this fructose-1,6-bisphosphate, this 6-carbon fuel, into 2 3-carbon fuels can happen 2 different ways. You can make what is called dihydroxyacetone phosphate, that's this left one, or you can make glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, which is often abbreviated as G3P. And those two possibilities are roughly equally likely as far as energetics is concerned. So they're both going to happen, and the cell doesn't know which is going to happen when it breaks the 6-carbon sugar apart. The problem here, it would be a problem, is that only one of these two possibilities, specifically glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, can go on to the rest of the process, can go on to the energy payoff phase. That's why you see a little white arrow down here. Dihydroxyacetone phosphate can't. And you're making this one that can't go on roughly half of the time. So that would be a very big waste of energy, right? A waste of fuel if you're stuck with something that can't be further processed. But luckily, it can be. If you do make dihydroxyacetone phosphate, the cell simply transforms that into the right stuff, which is glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. They are isomers of each other. They have the same chemical formula. And that's why the enzyme responsible for that is called isomerase. So whether you make some of this accidentally or not, all of it gets turned into glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. And per glucose, that means 2 of these get produced. Right? Because you started with a 1,6-carbon glucose, you end up with 2 glyceraldehyde 3-phosphates after these 5 steps that are the energy investment phase. And you had to spend it 2 ATP to do it. Now we can continue the flow chart in slide 13, which is the rest of the reaction, the pathway. Now we're seeing the detail of the energy payoff phase. And notice that what's coming in is the only stuff that was allowed, glyceraldehyde-3-phosphate. I guess I shouldn't say notice because they didn't write it up here, but that's what's coming in. All right? Well, the very first part of this energy payoff phase pays off right away because you have an empty taxi, NAD+, coming in and picking up two of the hydrogens from that fuel, from that G3P, reducing the NAD+ into NADH and H+, carrying a bunch of energy with it. And that happens right there. Now, there's two of them that do this, so it's really four hydrogens that get stripped. Okay, that's per glucose. Then in the next step, you have ATP being produced by substrate-level phosphorylation. This is why it pays off to have previously phosphorylated them by spending ATP. You're putting the phosphate back onto ADP to make ATP again. Okay? And then some more steps that are really just isomerizations. You then have some more ATP formed. Okay? So on a per glucose basis, you have to multiply all of these by two. Because this is happening for each of the two G3Ps that you broke glucose into. There's two of those now, right? You don't just have one fuel molecule, you have two. They each get processed identically. So per glucose, you have... That's why these are two, I should say. It's two ATP, two ATP, two NADH, because it's one for each of the two G3Ps. And therefore, on a per glucose, you spent two... You're making four ATP, and you're also earning two NADHs. Okay, now 14. I probably shouldn't even start 14. So let me just ask what part of this whole thing is problematic so far. There's a lot of steps, you mean? Yeah, there's a lot, definitely a lot of detail. I don't expect you to be able to explain this out loud right now. But what I'm trying to get you to try is to study the lecture recordings and your notes that you make from those recordings to the point of being able to put those notes away and explaining it one step at a time without looking at anything. That will tell you whether you're ready.
Okay.
But it's not going to happen immediately. You're going to have to listen repeatedly, and you're going to have to study the notes over and over. But that's what it'll take for Unit 3 test, which is usually the lowest mean. I don't want to discourage you by saying that. I want you to realize it so that you can prevent it. All right? Then let's adjourn for the week.